Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com.
Trying to choose the right supplements for the right horses often feels like a chore, and you have enough chores as it is. Fortunately, there's Equithrive, whose mission is to make this whole nutrition equation easier on you and much more beneficial to your horses. Equithrive's lineup of pelleted supplements are developed with care, backed by science, and 100% satisfaction guarantee. Not to mention picky eater approved. Whether you need advanced joint care for your equine athlete, gut or metabolic support, Equithrive is your one-stop shop for feed tub fortification. Do your horses and yourself a favor and visit equithrive.com. Use the promo code HumbleHoof and get 20% off your first order, plus free and fast shipping nationwide. Don't forget to use HumbleHoof, all one word, to get 20% off your first order at equithrive.com.
A special thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Cavallo. For our Humble Hoof listeners, they are offering 20% off their Cavallo Trek hoof boots using the coupon code HRN at checkout. The Trek is the world's most popular and versatile hoof boot and Cavallo's toughest trail boot, while also doubling as an option for therapy or rehab. The front closure system makes it easily adaptable to various hoof shapes, and TPU upper design allows for maximum strength while minimizing weight for the comfort and ease of movement for your horse. These are recommended by vets and trainers and also loved as transport boots by barrel racers, show jumpers, dressage riders, and everyone in between. Again, for 20% off a pair of Treks, use the code HRN at checkout at cavallo-inc.com. I first heard about Dr. Elizabeth Hilborn's book, Restoring Eden, from an equine podiatrist, actually, Megan Radkin. And she mentioned it just as a book to read out of interest. But when I read it, I realized that for those of us who are trying so hard to grow healthy hooves on horses, there might be some takeaways from some of these farming practices and ways that we manage our pasture or grow hay or treat hay that can possibly play a role in the horse's gut health and hoof health. So I reached out to Dr. Hilborn and she agreed to discuss a little bit about her own personal experiences and what she saw in the health of her land, the animals and wildlife on her land, and even her horses when it came to some issues that arose due to farming practices nearby. One thing I do want to mention is that Dr. Hilborn does talk about the term disruption when referencing the equine gut microbiome and kind of equates it to harming it. Dr. Hilborn wanted to clarify that we don't really know what harm to the microbiome actually looks like, since we can't consistently equate health outcomes with disruptions, especially in horses. So that's just something to think about when she talks about disruption in the microbiome and it harming it. So why don't we start, and can you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in veterinary medicine and how that sort of led to what you're doing right now?
Sure. Boy, it's kind of a long and tortured path, though. I wanted to be a vet since I was a little girl. Like, I knew when I was 7, and I remember announcing it to my neighbor when I was 9, and he laughed at me, and he said, "Girls can't be veterinarians." And when I graduated from vet school, I tried to call him to let him know that I actually was a veterinarian. But he had passed, unfortunately. Aww. But it's weird how those things stick with you when you're a kid, you know. And my mom blew it off. She was like, "You need to do what you need to do for yourself. So don't listen to other people." Yeah. Thank goodness she said that. But yeah. So I had a career as a registered nurse for 13 years. That's how I put myself through school. And when I entered veterinary school, finally, I had seen a lot of clinical medicine, and I knew the you know, the schedule, the time away from family. And I had a young daughter by that time. And I wanted a little more of a daytime job. And I also had the big picture. I had seen what direct patient care was and how, yes, you can make a change in one being's life or a family's life. But I was fascinated by public health because I could use my human medical nursing training. I could use my veterinary medicine. And so I went into a career in veterinary public health. And I currently have a veterinary I'm board certified in preventive medicine, veterinary preventive medicine.
Oh, wow.
But I currently have a side job as a honeybee exclusive veterinarian. And that came about because in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration regulates antibiotics. And we have a huge problem with antimicrobial resistance. So they put down a rule that came out in early 2017 that any antibiotic used in human medicine, if it's going to be used for a food animal, so that's livestock and honeybees make honey, any antibiotic that's also used in human medicine that's used with those food-producing animals has to be controlled through a veterinarian. The veterinary feed directive is the FDA rule, but access is controlled by a veterinarian. So I jumped at the chance. I grow fruit. I was like, wow, this is great. I can serve the pollinator community as a veterinarian. So that's how I ended up as a honeybee veterinarian.
That's so fascinating. I know, I read that at the end of your book, and I thought that was so cool because I've never heard of that before. And it's not something I really thought about because obviously honeybees are so small and so, in my mind, so delicate. It wasn't something that I really thought about in terms of, you know, caring for them in like a health way, which is obviously important when it comes to so many other things in our life, like our food. So that's really cool. And I guess that's a pretty good segue into talking a little bit about your book. And I read your book on a recommendation of someone I met at the NAEP Saratoga Vet and Farrier Conference this past September, Megan Radkin. And it was just so eye-opening and amazing. And I guess it's something that things I just hadn't really thought about when it comes to like how we're growing things and how we're caring for our land and our animals. And so I would love to have you tell us a little bit too about what your book is about before we kind of dive into some questions in regards to that.
Sure. Yeah. In 2017, within months of starting my business as a bee veterinarian, all the bees from my property were gone. It was so strange. Early in the spring, we had a flood, and it floods here frequently. We have a floodplain near the house, but we're high up on a hill, so it doesn't really affect us other than it used to swamp the horse pasture. I'd have to keep them in the upper fields. And then we'd have to go clean up the fences, you know, you'd get debris in the fences after a flood. But at that point, the fences were down and the flood wasn't a big deal until I went down to care for some trees. And on the way back, I noticed a wetland. I swung by to go look at it because it's one of my favorite places near the farm. It's usually full of life, like tadpoles and dragonflies and birds. And it was dead. There was nothing living in it. And there were dead insects laying around it. And within weeks, the moths disappeared from around our porch light. And then I noticed that the blossoms that should be covered with butterflies and bees were just bare. And I had no idea what was happening. Luckily, when I first saw the water with the dead insects, I had the presence of mind to collect water samples. But then after that, it was up to me to find help to figure out what had happened and to track down what the cause was. And it turned out to be agricultural runoff. And that really caught my attention when I realized it's not just our property. That wasn't an accidental thing that just happened to us. It's common for agricultural runoff to contaminate water to the point where the aquatic insects die. Animals that drink the water can be sickened or die. There can be amphibian death. There have been fish deaths associated with the contaminated water. So I had to write a book about my experience because when I was trying to figure out what had happened, I kept hearing, oh, I've never heard of such a thing. And then when I read the scientific literature, I realized, wow, this is happening everywhere these chemicals are used. So I thought I'd better write about it so that if it happened to other people, they could figure it out more easily. It really, so I became an author. Who knew?
Yeah. And honestly, it was so great. I don't even remember if we said the name of the book, but it's Restoring Eden. And I loved it. I mean, I read it in like a day and a half. So it was just, you know, something I couldn't put down because I wanted to know more about what happened. And it's interesting because I am brand new in owning my farm and I'm trying the best I can to keep the land as healthy as possible and the animals on it as healthy as possible. And that's something that really stood out to me when I read your book really, I mean, yeah, obviously we don't know how these products affect every living being and we don't have concrete evidence necessarily in a lot of different species, but even if there's a chance that it could cause harm, I want to make sure that I can avoid that. So When it comes to, you know, things like glyphosate, or I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, so please correct me if I do. Is it neonics?
The full name for the class of insecticide, I pronounce it neonicotinoids.
Okay.
I have heard it pronounced other ways, and then I shorten it to neonics, but again, I've heard it other ways, so.
Okay.
And thank you for your kind words about the book. Yeah, this really opened my eyes and changed my life.
Yeah.
This experience.
I'm sure. Yeah. And so, you know, on that same vein, I mean, there are so many pages where you talk about some of the things that you've learned coming from these, you know, pesticides and herbicides. But can you talk about some of the implications that we know about when it comes to these in regards to actual, you know, published studies or things that we can actually concretely say?
Yeah. So, if we're talking about the insecticides that got in the water from the field in 2017 that killed all the insects down there and most of the insects up above, the insecticides, the neonics, are a relatively new class of insecticides. They've really increased use in the last 20 years, and they're the most commonly used insecticides in the world today. And they were developed because they are were believed and still are generally believed to be less toxic to human beings than the older classes of insecticides. So it's, you know, progress moving forward. How do we grow food with the least amount of harm to the people eating the food? The side effects, as I see it, of these chemicals are they have different properties than older chemicals. They tend to be more water soluble, so they don't stay where they're sprayed on the field. I'm going to use corn as an example because that was the crop growing when the wetland was damaged, and I studied it the most deeply. The neonics are applied to the seed, so the farmer doesn't even have to spray it, doesn't have to do anything other than plant the seed. About 5% of the neonic is taken up by the crop and protects the crop. The other 95% goes off into the soil, into the water. When the soil is saturated, it moves with the water. It can move down into groundwater. It can move over the surface into ditches and wetlands and rivers and streams. And it's extremely potent. one corn seed has enough neonic on it to kill 80,000 honeybees.
Oh my goodness.
So for insects, it's very, very potent or strong. A low dose is effective. And it's can be very persistent. We still haven't fully recovered here.
Wow. And it's been 7 years?
Yeah, we're seeing more life, but especially the birds are really knocked back because we just don't have the butterflies and caterpillars that we used to have. And that's what they use to feed their babies. So I noticed that the most, the other big category for me are the very tiny pollinators, the tiny flower flies, the tiny wasps and bees that pollinate the smallest flowers. I planted a lot of viburnums. They're a shrub, a flowering shrub that make delicious drupes. Some of them are edible for humans, but they're an important food source for birds. And those aren't pollinated anymore because we don't have that class of small, tiny insects that can pollinate those flowers. Wow. So, you know, it's definitely very different here. But I just focus on the things that are getting better. Like we have carpenter bees back and we have bumblebees. And this year we have some lightning bugs. So I'm just really, you know, I focus on the happy things. So the other thing about neonics is that they are systemic. So when they run off in the water, when a plant takes that water up, they take the neonic up. It gets inside the plant. So that's another really useful thing for somebody growing plants who doesn't want any insect damage on the plant, on the fruit. So neonics are used to produce nursery plants so that you can go to the store and you can buy perfect plants with no little chew holes or anything on them. And it's a great way to grow fruit that is not blemished by insect damage because the neonics inside the whole plant, the fruit, so it protects everything. The downside is it can get into plants that animals use, that they must use, like pollinators, other wildlife eat plants, that if they're contaminated enough with neonics, the wildlife can be harmed by eating the plant or drinking nectar from it, collecting the pollen from it. You know, it's dose dependent. With insects, because they're so sensitive to neonics, they can be exposed. And if they're not killed, a second dose is cumulative. So if they keep feeding from a contaminated plant, their risk goes up with each feeding. So that was the biggest surprise to me, was that we'd gone from an agricultural model where people scouted their fields and looked for pests and then used insecticides if they needed to control an outbreak of pests to keep their crop. Now we've gone to a model where every time a crop is planted, it's treated with these neonics, whether it's needed or not, whether there's any insect pressure or not. And because insecticides are lethal for insects in general, they're not specific just to pests. It kills the good insects too. I saw it with my pollinators. I saw it with the dragonflies that disappeared. But also it kills the predator insects that would control an outbreak of pests on a crop. So if you're killing your predators, then you've lost your first line of defense in keeping a good healthy crop for sale. So the more you use, the more you decrease that predator population, the more you become dependent on using the insecticides.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that makes so much sense to me. I mean, I watched this documentary so many times, The Biggest Little Farm, about that farm in California and how and it's like an organic farm. And I don't know a lot about farming, but it made so much sense to me that everything worked in this like symbiotic relationship of, you know, if they let nature sort of take its course, there was a lot of like checks and balances within nature itself that kind of kept things handled. And I think too, like I worry so much. I mean, I run a horse hoof rehab facility. So I get horses that come in that are lame, you know, they have hoof issues. And a lot of times those hoof issues are a symptom, right? Like they have a metabolic problem or they have something else going on in their body that their feet are showing the signs of that. And I have horses here that diet becomes so important because, you know, a few bites of something that they can't handle and suddenly they can't walk. And, you know, this book sort of made me question a lot of that because as a kid, I don't remember that. You know, I don't remember worrying so much. And maybe it was just a lack of knowledge or a lack of observation. But, you know, I know that we can't make these, you know, correlation is not the same as causation. And I know that we can't make these leaps. But it made me wonder about a lot of these issues that are popping up. And, you know, is it stemming at all from how farming, like the direction that farming is going? You know, I have horses that can't have like a few bites of alfalfa without becoming very, very foot sore, which is a sign of inflammation in their feet.
Yeah.
And almost every horse that comes to my property, they end up being diagnosed with some kind of metabolic implication that, you know, the owner, previous owners hadn't found. And I just don't remember that when I was younger.
Yeah.
So. Having a hoof rehab facility, one main focus of ours is forage. I want the horses here to have safe, tested forage available 24/7 without the risk of becoming obese. I've spent years looking for the ideal slow feeder for us, and we have found it with Hay Boss feeders. When I tell you that my Hay Boss XL feeder has cut my feeding time by 90%, I mean it, and it might even be an understatement. The covered feeders with integrated slow feed nets allow for all my horses here to have access to hay all the time, which is healthy for their guts and minds. They're also not able to completely binge all at once, because the nets keep them in check. They're available all over North America right now, but side note, if you're in New England, I got mine from Mountain Lane Farm, who delivered it right to me and showed us how to set it up and use it. We can't imagine our lives without it here.
Well, I'm not an equine specialist, so, you know, take that into account. I do have horses, and I know what you're talking about. And when I was writing the book and going deep into the literature, I thought about it as something that happened to us back in 2014. It was the second year that our neighbor had started farming. And that spring, I had, let's see, he was a 19-year-old and about a 14-year-old. So my 19-year-old was a gelded quarter horse type, a small horse. The 14-year-old is a gelded Shetland type pony. And I had been managing them for over a decade on our grass. I rotated them among four pastures, fescue, white, a little bit of white clover. In the upper pastures, I had crabgrass as summer forage. And they were both easy keepers, so I had to be really careful how long I left them on turnout every day. Mm-hmm. And the pony was in a grazing muzzle all the time, because if he looked at grass, he would gain weight.
Yeah.
So in the spring of 2014, I was leading them to the pasture, and I noticed they were both climbing the banks of the gravel walk. Like, they didn't want to walk beside me. They were starting to climb up onto the softer soil beside. And the first day, I didn't put two and two together. And the second day, I was like, oh my gosh, they're foot sore. And they weren't exactly in sync. I think the pony got sick first, and then within 10 days, the horse did. And they both got laminitis so badly. For the pony, he regained his soundness pretty quickly, but it destroyed his gut. Mm-hmm. He could not tolerate fiber. I was going around trying all these different hays, and I'd had them on pretty stemmy hay because they were such easy keepers. If I had them on good hay, they'd chew it up and be done and be wanting more. So I purposefully had fed them lower quality hay. They were young and that's what they needed. Well, the pony couldn't tolerate it anymore. I had to buy him like pregnant mare hay, you know, really nice orchard grass, or that's what we have in the South. I guess up there it'd be Timothy, but, and he had chronic diarrhea for 8 years. I tried everything. The horse got really bad laminitis, and I had the vet, you know, I didn't know Megan, the podiatrist, yet. I don't know if she'd graduated from school yet, but I had a veterinary specialist here. I had farrier specialists. He ended up in special therapeutic shoes. And I kept thinking, oh, well, I can get them back out on grass. And, you know, I'd give them like 10 minutes of grazing the first day, 20 minutes the second day. I was easing them out. I'd get to 40 minutes and the horse would get laminitic every single time. And I just gave up. I took all my fences down. I was like, I can't use my pastures anymore. Yeah. So since about, I want to say 2015 or 2016, when I just gave up on trying to introduce them back, they've been in stalls, paddocks, and a dry lot. And I finally got the pony on. He still breaks with diarrhea sometimes, but he's mostly stable. But he had a really bad bout of metabolic syndrome last year, and I don't know why. I soak all their grass hay. I do give them alfalfa, but we have a local mill. I buy organically grown alfalfa that does not have the pesticides in it that I worry about for microbial health. Now, what do I mean when I say pesticides that I worry about for microbial health? This is my experience talking. We do not have good evidence for which pesticides may be associated with gut damage. The reason I have been focusing on glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup for my guys, is in 2014, they were drinking from that wetland, and the farmer, it was the time of year where the farmer had just cleared his field and we'd had rain. I checked my rainfall records. We'd have recent rain, and I suspect that there was runoff of the Roundup, the glyphosate, into the wetland that they like to drink from. Of course, I gave them a trough of clean drinking water. No, that's not good enough. The wetland's better. So they both became ill a few days after the rain, within 10 days of each other, and neither of them have recovered. So I suspected when I wrote the book, I was like, whoa, I had no idea that glyphosate could hurt the gut microbiome. And we know for horses, the gut microbiome is everything. Mm-hmm. What do I mean hurt the microbiome? I mean change it. All we know is that glyphosate kills bacteria, some bacteria more than others, and that in the gut, it's clear that animals, and most of the works in rodent models, animals dosed with glyphosate have changes in their gut microbiome. Does it make them sick in some reliable way? No, the effects are all over the place.
Wow.
So, in fact, some appear to be positive effects. All we know is it can change the gut microbiome. So I've been feeding my horses organic hay, organic alfalfa pellets, but they still get commercial feed. The big guy's 29 now, and he gets Purina Equine Senior, and he's gained weight on it. He looks great on it. So I don't know, and I really, really, really hope that more people will do research in this area, because there's a lot of information for rodent models. There's much less. There are papers out there for different kinds of livestock, mostly cattle, but some others. But there's nothing consistent. We don't know, like, is this a risk? Is for health? Is it not something we don't need to worry about? We don't know. Right. I'm just being cautious.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I think there's a big push to look into the equine microbiome, because, like, the gut microbiome, because, you know, they're linking that to a lot of different, you know, health and behavioral things even. I'm actually going to be speaking to someone later this week about the gut microbiome and how to improve that in horses and what that could possibly affect when it comes to their hoof health or just overall health.
So
that is something that would be concerning to me if that's something that could have a negative effect.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. And I guess, so another question I have, and I don't know if this is something that is even a worthwhile question, but you know, when it comes to things like Roundup, you know, you see that, it dissipates or whatever within, depending on what one you use, within like 3 days to a few weeks, and then it's completely gone is what this mention is in all their products. But in the book, you've mentioned that it's not really consistent with what you were seeing in terms of like the breakdown of the plants and things like that. Is that something that, I don't know, does it break down or not? Do we even know?
Yes. So there's quite a bit of literature actually on how it breaks down in the environment. This is my understanding. This is not my area of expertise, but this is my walking around knowledge from deep reading on this. The first issue about it going away quickly, that's true when it's sprayed in a situation where there's mostly bare soil. The microbes break it down quickly.
Interesting.
When there is vegetation left, like the corn stubble left in a field or wheat straw after the wheat's been sprayed to dry it out for harvest, the Roundup doesn't break down until the vegetation has decomposed. So in my situation, I found wheat straw that was a couple years old that had been pushed by floodwaters into the wetland, and it was still releasing glyphosate 2 years after spraying. And I took a sample of it and sent it off with my water samples, and they found glyphosate in the straw, as well as its breakdown product, which is abbreviated as AMPA. There's some good papers about, I guess, some glyphosate is used in forestry management. There are some good papers about it persisting in the root systems in the forest. After the plants are sprayed, it can persist. And it can have effects on the surrounding soil and on nearby plants. So I had no idea before this happened to me, and I, you know, had the experience with the wheat straw, but it is pretty well documented out there.
Wow. Yeah, and obviously that has its, I mean, we don't really know exactly what this is all doing in terms of health and things like that, but that will have some kind of implications if it's lasting longer than originally thought.
I want to make a point. We're talking about glyphosate and the equine microbiome, but I want to make a point that the equine microbiome is, I think of it as being exquisitely sensitive. If you think about our modern day lives, horses are exposed to so many things now that they weren't when we were kids, like maybe perfluorinated compounds, you know, like the the materials used in Teflon and Scotchgard, you know, the forever chemicals.
Yeah.
Those were just getting started in the 50s, but they really took off during the 80s and 90s with all the stain-resistant clothing. And so perfluorinated compounds can disrupt the horse microbiome. Other pesticides, other than glyphosate, can disrupt the microbiome. Grains are treated with pyrethroid insecticides to keep like grain weevils out of them. So things like that, that commercial horse feed I'm feeding has low concentrations of pesticides in it, pesticide residues. The plastics break down into nanoparticles and maybe in storage, you know, we know that plastic packaging, abrasion can add plastic to foods in storage. All my feed bags are plastic now. Mm-hmm. We know fire retardants can harm the microbiome. Dioxins from forest fires and burning. And heavy metals like arsenic in water or lead contamination if there's a smelter nearby or fluoride. So I just wanted to throw that out there that, you know, in my story, I really focused on the glyphosate because of the runoff into the water that the horses drank. But in reality, our animals are exposed to so many potential toxicants that can harm their guts. So I just wanted to get that out there. Antibiotics, of course, you know, we've all seen that. Need to treat a horse for an infection and they break with diarrhea.
Right. Yeah. And I know, I mean, that's definitely something that I think about too, is really there's so many things, even with people, that can affect our gut. And that's why I'm hoping to talk to that veterinarian later this week about ways to kind of improve the equine gut microbiome, because I do think, I don't think there's enough research on it, but I do think there is some connection between hoof health and gut health.
Absolutely.
Because if the gut isn't healthy, then how are they even absorbing their nutrients properly or getting it to where it needs to go? So, yeah.
Absolutely. I look forward to that talk.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I'm hoping I can, have that be the next episode after this one, because that would be a really great, really great backup to this one. Yeah, and I guess, I mean, I feel like I have so many questions and a lot of questions that I think we don't even have answers to yet. But I think for something that's maybe practical for listeners, is there anything that owners can do if they are worried about, you know, providing their horse with healthy forage or keeping their farm healthy? Are there ways that they can take steps to do that and maybe avoid some of these insecticides?
Well, I think that in general, pesticides, an herbicide is a pesticide, so I'm including all the pesticides right now, should be used as a last resort. They all have effects on living things that we don't want to kill.
Right.
Unintended effects, friendly fire. They're never so specific that they only kill the one thing we're worried about.
Right.
So minimizing pesticide use, I think, is a really good place to start. And thinking about the quality of the feed that you're feeding, you know, some feed can be contaminated with toxic plants too, like hay. Can blister beetles and alfalfa. And so the quality of the feed's really important, to store it well, to make sure that things don't get moldy or rodent infested. And boy, is that easy in a barn. You know, it's not temperature controlled. Rodents can be everywhere. So just to do our best, but you know, that's all I got, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, now it's something that I've kind of been diving into since reading your book. And it's so tempting to, you know, like looking out at my field, like right now it's bug season and it's hard to not want to just like go after some of these bugs. But it's been interesting since reading your book, like noticing those little things. Like I noticed more dragonflies and like barn swallows and things that are kind of going after some of the unwanted pests and making me sit on my hands a little bit to just try to kill everything that is, you know, bothering the horses, because ultimately it's probably not going to have the desired effect in the long run.
Yeah. One thing that's really been a game changer for me, I don't know if you've heard of them, but I use fly predators in my barn.
Yeah, I do. I just started. Well, last year I used them, but we had so many flooding rains, like just downpours, that I don't know that I saw as much of an effect. But I have been using them this year too.
Oh, well, I hope they help. I started out as a new horse keeper with just so many fly strips hanging around, getting stuck to everything. And the fly predators have been a real game changer for the horse's comfort. And, you know, having a run-in shed, having a fan on in the stall, you know, the pests can't really fly very well in the flow from a fan. So right. Just mechanical barriers to keeping flies off of horses can help too. But yeah, I know we've been trained to grab a spray bottle when we see something we don't like. And that training is coming home to roost, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time. And again, I really enjoyed your book, and I can add a link to it when I post this episode. And I'm sure that other people will really enjoy reading it. So I think it would be a really great thing for them all to check out.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me. And I may be calling you with horse questions, because keeping horses sound, keeping their guts healthy, it's a 24/7 job now. It really is.
Yeah, I 1,000% understand. Yeah, I get it. That's my full-time job now. So it can be stressful, but I'm glad that we're kind of making some advances in a lot of those ways. So hopefully we just continue, and hopefully more research can come out so that we can kind of pinpoint some more things to work on.
I really hope so. I think you had sent me a story recently, an anecdote. I think, you know, all these anecdotes, who knows, but I hope it will at least spur some research so that we do know how to manage the land we have our horses on so that we're not putting them at risk.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I really want to thank you for your work. And it's so important, because going through that metabolic syndrome with the pony, I was afraid we were going to lose him this year.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's so scary.
Feel free to reach out whenever you have questions. Not that I'll necessarily have the answer, but I'm always happy to help.
Thank you. And let's hope that conversations like these will spur more research, and that 20 years from now, you'll be saying, huh, you know, I'm not as busy as I was.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And more time to ride.
I know, right, exactly. I would love that. Thank you. This was great, and I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm excited to publish this on Friday.
Oh, I'm excited too. I hope you have a great evening.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I always say that I'm slightly more hoof-obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.